Last week we were socializing and taking a bit of time to get quiet, so Ray bought me a little bell. She said I should use the bell here. but it might take me a while to get used to the concept, but I'm sure we can do that. It takes very nice anyway.
You never know when
you leave. That's right, yeah, for sure. So welcome to part two. Of your worth, developing the ideas of healthy self-perception, self-esteem, discovering our intrinsic value. Last week we talked about the importance of understanding our intrinsic value and what that means to have a healthy self-perception. And we developed a definition of what is true healthy self-esteem and what isn't. Because we talked about the problem of people using wrong terminology and especially in today's modern thinking of distorting and almost abusing the various values so that it becomes something that is destructive rather than constructive. So when we talked about the definition of self-esteem, we explained that it's not, the intention is not an inflated ego or a false sense of achievement and accomplishment. And it's not about praising people for things that they haven't done or crediting people for things that they haven't really accomplished. Right? But what it is, what self-esteem is, as we explained last week, it's the belief, the true belief, the acknowledgement that each and every one of us have an intrinsic value and that we all have competencies. And competencies, we all have an intrinsic value because we are created in the image of God, as we talked about last week, and that's why it's such a critical concept from a Jewish point of view, from Jewish thinking. And therefore, we must have an intrinsic value if we created in the image of God, because we become part of His greater reality, really. We have that divine imprint. And that we all have competencies, and we explained in the final that competencies doesn't mean talents in the modern sense necessarily. But it does mean that each and every one of us have an ability to contribute towards the meaning and the purpose of creation, right? And to make this place make this world a better place in our own way. But we're going to talk about competencies a little bit later, perhaps, as well, and next week as well. And therefore, we explained last week that this concept of being comfortable with ourselves and having a healthy self-perception is actually synonymous. It's not synonymous with overconfidence or arrogance, but it is synonymous with the idea of bittul, that idea of humility that we talked about last week, because humility, or even the idea of bittul, which means self-nullification, does not mean that I'm a nothing. But on the contrary, it means I have no independent value that is separate from other people, and I'm not superior to anyone else, but I am something on the contrary. Being humble means that I am divinely created, which makes me not superior to other people, but makes me part of a greater and more infinite reality. Which is why we explained the whole idea of Hillel, if you remember, just to recap, that Hillel said he was the most humble of people, but yet he said, if I am here, everyone is here. Because it's precisely that feeling of being comfortable with ourselves and realizing that we are not self-created and self-made, but we are what we are, strengths and weaknesses and intrinsic value is a gift of God. And we become comfortable with that, and we accept the whole of ourselves, we're then able to make room for others and have healthy relationships. And that's what he meant by, if I am here, everyone is here. So, what I want to do today is develop this idea and start to talk about some strategies of how we actually internalize this concept and learn to start believing ourselves in our own intrinsic value, in our own competencies, and take responsibility for our own weaknesses and being okay with it. But I want to do that with beginning with a piece that... Where is she? Judy, where are you?
Yeah.
Oh, there we are. Thank you. Judy sent me a nice piece this week. Or maybe not. Maybe it's not such a nice piece, but it's an important piece of an article which talks about a principal in Toronto that at the beginning, apparently the beginning of 2012, just following on from last week, about the abusive terminology and the confusion of what things actually mean. It happens to be this piece talks about a principal whose name is Dennis Prager. I don't think it's the same Dennis Prager, by the way. Uh-huh. He doesn't live in Toronto. So it must be someone else. But anyway, a new principal got up at a high school in Canada, in Toronto, on the first day of school, and said the following. He said, "I am your new principal." He said, "I'm your new principal, and honored to be so. There's no greater calling than to teach young people. But," he said, "I would like to appraise you of some important changes coming to our school. I am making these changes because I'm convinced that most of these ideas that have dominated public education in Canada have worked against you, against your teachers, against your parents, and against our country." Okay. Then he goes on and he starts to list a whole bunch of changes that he's making, and the first few focus on sort of equality and Canadianism. Everyone is Canadian, he says. It doesn't matter what background you come from, doesn't matter what ethnic background you come from. Emphasis on the English language, and everyone's going to just learn to, I don't care what language you speak, but everyone has to speak English, and so on and so forth. And then he goes on and he says, and number five, says, "Fifth, we will end all self-esteem programs." Okay? Wouldn't have liked the series, I guess. "In this school," he says, "in this school, self-esteem will be attained in only one way. The way people attain it will be by earning it from their fellow students and teachers. One immediate consequence of this is that there will be only one class valedictorian, not eight." Okay, what do they call it here? Ducks, right? Yeah. Is that what it's called here? Ducks. Yeah. So to put it into the Australian language, but only one ducks, not eight. Okay. This is a completely absurd piece because it's a typical example of what I spoke about last week, the pendulum effect. That always happens, right? People acknowledge a problem, introduce a concept, misuse it and abuse it to its extreme, then decide it hasn't worked, and then swing it all the way back to the other extreme. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to use this and go off on a tangent and develop it, and we'll come back to it to understand why this is such a misunderstanding of what self-esteem is, and why it's actually... his suggestion is actually crazy, and I'll come back to it soon. Because no one says, and no one would suggest it anyway, that making a child feel good about themselves means that you encourage them not to work hard. I mean, that's just ridiculous. On the contrary, we'll develop next week that if you have a healthy self-esteem, you then start to work hard. Right? No one also suggests that it should be okay if you don't achieve anything. This chair's down there. No one suggests that if someone decides to sit back and relax and not do any work and not accomplish any homework, or an adult not to accomplish anything and just to sit back and relax and enjoy the beach, that we should be able to say to the person, "Well, you know, self-esteem, you need to accept yourself, you're okay the way you are." No, you're not okay the way you are, because a person is born to work. So no one's suggesting that would be the meaning and interpretation of self-esteem. But what we do need to understand is that what self-esteem does, it creates a new definition of the human being. And when that new definition of the human being is there, the consequences are very different. And the issue no longer becomes, is there's one ducks or eight ducks. The issue then becomes, who do we recognize and who don't we recognize? And what is the true value of a person? And what I'll show you at the end is that my belief is that there shouldn't be eight ducks and there shouldn't be one ducks, because the whole idea of a duck is ridiculous. But I'll come back to that as we go through what I want to share with you today. We'll come back to this piece. So, the very, very first foundation of understanding the concept of self-esteem and developing that idea of a healthy self-perception is this. It's to learn and to develop an understanding and to get used to not defining ourselves by the perception of other people. That is the 101 of this concept. Right. It's to understand that the constant desire that so many of us have, right, the desire and the need for approval from other people, creates within ourselves a very, very unhealthy dependency. And self-destruction. Now, let's understand that. All right, is that clear? That's a very important definition. Okay. See, many people, and I suspect many of us, spend enormous amount of time trying to impress other people. Right? Why do we do that? Because we are used to a definition of identity that defines us by the way others look at us. Right? In other words, our definition comes from the outside in. We spend an amazing amount of time seeking approval from other people. Friends, family, others. Right? We therefore put in tremendous effort to avoid any rejection from other people. One of the most devastating things to most human beings is rejection or criticism. Because rejection or criticism means that we haven't achieved, that we haven't received that approval from the other human being, and we fall apart. So many of us spend time making sure everything is so perfect, because what will the other person say? I'm sure you can all think of examples. Right? What happens if you had a really, really hectic day, and you come home, and you really need a rest, and then you sit down to relax and suddenly understand that in 10 minutes someone is dropping by and the house is not 100% the way it happened. It's not a zoo. It's not a jungle. It's not unhygienic. It's not perfect. But it's not perfect, right? Come on, the honest truth. What are you going to do? Are you going to keep relaxing? Or are you going to jump up in an unbelievably stressed frenzy and say, "Oy vey, I can't send him to see the house like that," right? And so on and so forth, right? We constantly worry and we take on board and we internalize and we think about the whole time, consciously, what are others thinking? It's such a habit that we've developed, right? Because the truth is that most of us do have a problem with, most people naturally have a problem with self-esteem, do you know that? They're not sure why, but most human beings don't have natural, healthy self-perception. And therefore, as a consequence, define themselves by what other people think. They're not sure why. I think I told you this once. I once did a scientific experiment. The thing it's got to do with the perception of children vis-a-vis the world, you see. They once did an experiment like this, where they took adults, and they built a house that the adult should live in the house with dimensions of a child. So in other words, you realize when a child is born, everything is like beyond their reach. So they built chairs, tables, light switches, everything that would be out of their reach as it is to a child. And they locked the adults in there, and after a week they started showing symptoms. Right? Because it's very, very difficult to be in a world where you're out of control, where you can't achieve anything, where you need assistance for everything else. Right? So maybe that's got to do with it. Or maybe it's got to do with the environment. Maybe it's got to do with the way parents brought them up. Maybe it's got to do with the message they receive from society. Whatever it is, it's not really relevant. But I don't believe it's only got to do with the way children grow up. But it's got to do with lots of things. But the bottom line is that most people don't have such a healthy self-esteem. Even if they're very talented, even if they accomplish and they achieve a great deal. About Dr. Tversky, who I told you last week, writes extensively on this topic. Talks about his own journey, even though he was a very talented and very, very clever doctor, but he realized that he suffers from this insecurity. Mm-hmm. And he tells many stories, and one of the stories he tells... one of the stories he tells is when he was giving a lecture. And... there was a couple of hundred people there. And you know, sometimes after lecture, people give out evaluation sheets, anonymous evaluation sheets. And there was like 150 of these sheets came back, and they all gave raving reports, except for one guy who said his lecture was terrible. And he said he realized that the next week, he kept on thinking about this one guy. It's like a crazy thing. We all do this. You know, in this environment, I'm very honest. I'll tell you a story that happened to me this morning. I don't do this to everyone, only with you. You know, everyone has strengths and weaknesses. One of my strengths is punctuality. I don't have a challenge with punctuality. Okay, so that's just what it is. All right? I've often been made fun of because I come from Hasidim, and Hasidim are typically always late. But I grew up, you know, all my friends, when I grew up in Johannesburg, there was a very strong German community. They're called Yekkers. Right? And all my friends, I went to school, they were all very, very punctual. I'll tell you, in fact, how punctual they were. They used to advertise. This is an unbelievable thing. This is a true thing, what I'm going to tell you. They used to advertise on Shabbat afternoon, for the afternoon service, they could advertise that Mincha begins at 5:17. I'm not joking. But the greatness was that at 5:05, the shul was completely empty. 5:07 or 5:08, it would start to fill out. 5:10, 5:11, and then 5:12, it was completely full. The chazan would stand at the front, and he'd watch the clock. 5, 5:17. He's off. He's there. Right? Anyway, that's how I grew up. So we have a morning minyan every day, right? And people know I'm generally on time. Today something happened this morning, and I was late, and I got delayed, and I walked in late. I'm honest, this is truth, right? So I walked in late, and a new guy was there. And I felt so bad. A new guy. And then, as I felt bad, I thought to myself, are you nuts? You just sat down preparing this. I was preparing this thing, right? And I think that's exactly what you're doing. What do you mean you felt bad? So what? So a new guy was there. So you'll think that I'm a late driver. So what? So what?
It's not so what, though. You're still talking.
That's what I'm sharing with you. Exactly. I'm sharing with you how difficult this is. It's not easy. But what I'm about to share with you is funny, but it's not easy. Because we all do it. It's like a sort of a natural, we're naturally drawn to this concept, right? I mean, I don't worry about the guys that come every day, because they know about, I've got a good record. But the new guy, why did a new guy come today? Couldn't have chosen a different day to come, you know what I mean? And I've told you the story from Haman, right? From the story of Purim. Where Haman is elevated to an unbelievable state of promotion. He's the prime minister, he's rich, he's wealthy, everyone's bowing down to him, he's invited to a banquet with Esther and the queen, and he comes out of the palace and there's one old Jew that won't bow down to him, Mordechai. And he gets angry and he goes home and he says the most powerful line of the whole Megillah story. He tells his wife and children how much he's loved and how much he's a prime minister and how promoted he is and how wealthy he is and how lucky he is and how he was the only one invited to the banquet together with Esther and Ahasuerus. And then he says, V'chol zeh einenu shoveh li. He says, this is all worth nothing to me as long as Mordechai the Jew refuses to bow down. Are you crazy? You've got everything, but because one guy out there refuses to give you approval, everything falls apart? It's so bizarre, and yet we all do it to some level. Why? Because Haman's whole definition was the outside world. So if there's a crack in that outside approval, his whole identity falls apart. And it comes to such an extreme that our whole identity starts to develop around the perception of other people. I read once a very, very beautiful little anecdote. It says a man came to complain to his rabbi and he said, I know I'm a fool, rabbi. But I don't know what to do about it. Please advise me what to do. So the rabbi says to him, look, my son, you know, it's not so bad. Look, normally fools think that they're the wisest people of the earth, right? So the fact that you know you're a fool is not so bad. It means you're actually wise. So then he said to him, so then why does everyone say that I'm a fool? Ah, says the rabbi, I thought you considered yourself a fool because you had come to that conclusion on your own. But now that you have no self-opinion and you judge yourself by what others say to you, you really are a fool. So what are the consequences of this? What are the consequences of walking around developing an identity that is so dependent on other people? First of all, the first consequence is an incredible stress. It's very stressful to always be worried about what other people think of you. Right? And then you've got to do certain things because what is this one going to say? And what's this one going to think? And what, you know, that kind of thing. And what happens is, the second consequence is, when we don't get that approval, we beat ourselves up, we berate ourselves, and we fall into a state of complete despair and despondency. The third consequence is that sometimes we are pushed to do, now we're going to talk about this in a few minutes because this is very important, but sometimes we push to do good things, and we do things that are really intrinsically good, but we do them only because we want to get approval from others, and then we resent it. We resent it because I didn't do it because I thought it was a good thing, I did it because I felt forced. I felt I had to. I felt compelled because what is everyone going to say? So you do a good thing and you end up resenting goodness. And then the other consequence is we have a total lack of balance. You see, if we live our lives always surrounded by what other people are going to think, life is very complicated and life has a lot of things to balance and a lot of people to attend to. We have different needs and different obligations. We have family, we have business, we have community, we have social, we have all different types of things that are pulling us in different directions. And if our identity is based on trying to please everyone, we become a complete mess because we get pulled in everyone's direction and we try hard not to disappoint anyone and we end up disappointing everyone and ourselves. And we become a complete cholent, as they say. Now, let's just understand this concept a little bit because we need to clarify it. First of all, we need to understand, of course, giving to other people and making other people feel good is important, right? Compassion, kindness, giving is a foundation in Jewish thought. So the second thing we need to realize is, of course, this can't be taken to an extreme because we don't live in a vacuum, right? And in fact, it's part of Jewish thinking and part of Jewish literature that actually we do have an obligation to create pleasantness for the other person, right? We, in Pirkei Avot, in the Ethics of the Fathers, it says that what is a true good person? It's a person that does what is right in the eyes of God, but also does what is right in the eyes of people. So it's not that we have a total right to ignore the perception of other people. We don't. We have a responsibility to others. We have a responsibility to like others, to give to others, to connect to others. And we have a responsibility to make it easier for other people to like us, right? That's part of the human function. Part of the social interaction is that we are part of a society, we're part of a community, we're part of a people, and we have to put our little bit in that there is pleasantness, there is liking one to another, there is that approval on some level, one to another. There's another concept that's talked about in the Talmud, that it is, you know, in English they say it's not only good to do what's right, but you have to do what seems to be right. That fact, that's a Jewish concept. In other words, you're not allowed to put yourself in a situation where someone else suspects you of doing wrong, even though I know I've done the right thing, but no, there is a bit of effort that we're supposed to do, we're supposed to put in. That people, not only have we done the right thing, but it's been seen to be the right thing. Why? Because we have a moral obligation to make justice and to make morality attractive. And therefore, when we do things that seem to be immoral or seem to be wrong, we make values and we make morality unattractive. And therefore, we have that obligation. And we don't have the luxury just to say, well, I don't care. It's not my business what they think. I know what I've done and that's it. Because we don't live in that bubble. We don't live in isolation. And we have that moral obligation one to another. Right? So, we're not talking about becoming isolated. We're not talking about becoming selfish or self-centered, right? But what we're really talking about is dependency. Right? It's a little bit like food. Right? Food is important. Food is critical. Food is very bad when you're dependent on it. Meaning in an unhealthy way. Right? Alcohol tastes good. It's okay to have a l'chaim once in a while. Dependency on alcohol is a disaster. Right? And I think the same thing is true with the effort that we put in to gain and achieve the approval from other people. No one likes to be hated. No one likes to be ignored. Of course, everyone likes a bit of a compliment. Everyone likes to feel good. Everyone has that obligation, as I just said, to make sure that other people are pleased to a certain level. It's when our identity becomes that. That's the problem. Right? There's nothing wrong in putting an effort so other person is pleased or the other person gives you approval. That's fine. It's the dependency and it's the extreme and it's the creation of a self-identity that is totally dependent on the perception of other people. That's when it becomes destructive. That's when it becomes a real problem. That's the first thing. The second thing we need to understand is this. Let's talk about the concept of giving. Chesed, kindness, giving in Jewish thought is central, right? You know, in the portions of the week that we're reading now, the Torah portion of the week, we're reading about Abraham, the father of the Jewish nation. The hallmark, the absolute brand of Abraham Avinu was hospitality, was giving, going out of his way for others. Right? The whole concept of putting yourself, the ability to put yourself aside and to make room for another human being, that's central to all relationships. It's central to personal growth. We talk about this on and on, right? However, when we give, and I need to put a disclaimer here, I'm not suggesting that we should ever stop giving. On whatever level we do, whether it's friends or whether it's people, and whatever we give of ourselves, of our possessions, it doesn't matter. Giving is an amazing thing, right? And even if we give for the wrong reasons, giving can never go really wrong. So what I'm about to say certainly is not meant to discourage anyone from that concept of giving. But on the other hand, often we give from a weakness, not from a strength. And that's very unhealthy. When we give, we should be giving from a strength. We should be giving because we have that ability to make room for another human being. When we give from a weakness, in other words, when we give because we have no identity, when we give because we need to impress someone else to have some sort of feeling of self, right? When we give because we are so insecure that we need that approval from other people, then what we're actually doing is completely the opposite of selflessness. That type of giving, as I say, giving is always good, but at the bottom line, that type of giving is a giving where we're not making room for another person. What we're actually doing with that giving is feeding our own insecurity. We're trying to build ourselves up because we have such an insecure identity that we need to give in order to protect our own identity. And that achieves the exact opposite of what giving is supposed to achieve. In other words, sometimes you can have two people. The one is incredibly selfish, and the one is incredibly selfless, or it appears to be that way. And actually they both suffer from exactly the same problem, because it's an unhealthy selflessness. Selfish people are selfish because they are self-centered, coming from the problem that they have to protect their own identity. They are so fragile at the very core. They're so not comfortable with themselves. They so don't accept themselves that they have to fiercely defend their own identity. And the way they react to it is by being selfish. You shut everyone else out. So therefore there's no threat. There's no danger. And I can work on just preserving my own very fragile self. And some people do the exact same thing in the opposite way. They have such a need to protect their own fragile identity that they can never say no to anyone, that they'll go out of their way to seek approval from other people because they're fighting the entire time to defend that very, very fragile self. And some people do both depending on what the situation is. And when that happens, why it's so unhealthy is because it doesn't yield good results normally. Right? What happens is we become bitter. We become unhappy. You ever heard people complain, oh, I had to get up in the morning to take them somewhere, or I had to do this, I had to do that. First of all, who said you had to? What do you mean, I had to? They asked me, I had to. Right. Couldn't say no. Right. The first sign of someone who's giving from a weakness, not from a strength, is that they just can never say no. Which is, when you can never say no, you know something's wrong. Because when you give from a strength, then first of all, there has to be a balance. You have to give because it's right to give. You have to give because I'm comfortable with myself and therefore I make room for you. But if I'm comfortable with myself, not because I need your approval, but because I'm doing the right thing, because I can make room for other people. And therefore, if tomorrow morning there's another need, or someone else needs me, or something else needs me, or I need me, sometimes a person needs to take a break. Sometimes certain people need to know themselves. Some people overextend themselves to the point where they fall apart. So therefore, if tomorrow morning someone else needs me, or something else needs me, or I need me, I'm okay to say no, because I didn't give of myself for the other person's approval. So I can say no. Today I can't do it, but tomorrow I could. But when you give from a weakness, then you fall apart, because you always need to do it, because the whole basis of it is you're looking for the other person's approval, and therefore you can never say no, and the consequence is being bitter and very unhappy. As I said before, the second consequence is you get tied up in unbelievable tension. You get pulled in all separate directions because you want everyone's approval. And therefore there's no sense of priority. There's no decision making. There's no decisiveness. Because I'm always worried, am I doing the right thing? Because is someone else going to be happy? Are they happy with my answer? Am I happy with my response? Are they happy with my giving? How do I balance the two things, or the two people that are pulling me in different directions? You become negative. These type of people normally end up becoming more negative than positive, although they're engaged in positivity, but they end up becoming negative, right?
What if it's family obligations?
Okay, obligations. That's a right? That's a different story. I mean,
you still come.
Okay, no. The point is not to stop giving. The point is to learn how to give from a strength, and then you know how to balance it. It's not about. You can't go from the end. From the bottom up, you got to go from the inside. In other words, it's about learning to give from a strength. And when you give from a strength, then you know how to balance it. Then that's the second stage. But we'll talk about that as we go along. Right? Another consequence is that sometimes people's identity becomes so dependent on other people. You find this very often. Sometimes you find people are good people, or they're taking care of people, taking care of an elderly parent, or whatever the case, but it becomes their whole life. In fact, their whole, not because out of weakness, it becomes their whole life because their whole identity becomes taking care of someone else. They have no self-identity. And that's a very scary thing, because often when that person that they're doing things for is no longer here, they fall completely apart because they have no self-identity. And often a consequence of this whole thing is that we become so tied up with seeking approval from other people that we actually give up. Because it's too hard. And when we give up, we can't grow and we can't accomplish. You know, giving up, I just saw something so beautiful lately. And it's got to do with this. It's not directly related, but I'll share with you anyways. It's got to do with this week's Torah portion. In this week's Parsha, Lech Lecha, we read a story of Abraham waging a war against, there was a whole story of the four kings and the five kings. And Abraham waged a war to save his nephew. And it says there that he put together a little army. And he put together an army of 318 people. And the commentators asked the question, what exactly was the calculation of 318 people? Like, why do you need 318 people? So you know, in Hebrew, everything has a numerical value. And the Talmud discusses a concept called Yiush. Yiush means to give up hope, to be despondent. To give up. Yiush, the word Yiush, has the numerical value of 317. So this is what the commentaries say, that Abraham put together an army of 318. He stayed above the Yush. He went above the despondency, the feeling of giving up hope. And then you can fight the war. But often, going back to our topic, when we run around always trying to seek the approval of others, and we don't have that sense of self, the healthy sense of self, we actually end up giving up. It becomes too overwhelming, too hard, too difficult, and we give up. And once a person gives up, there's no hope. Giving up is one of the most destructive traits. Yush, this concept of despondency, giving up, just completely destroys a person. So therefore, when we talk about the whole concept of giving, this idea of seeking approval from others is a very, very important concept. We have to give. Giving is one of the making way for others, doing for others. We can't talk about it enough, how fundamental it is, the whole concept of tzedakah, charity. It's the foundation, perhaps, it's the core, it's the brand of Jewish thinking. But it has to be from a strength. We have to get used to doing it because it's the right thing to do, because we're comfortable to do it, because we're not insecure, not because we are insecure, because we're not insecure, because we've learned to accept ourselves, and we're going to learn how to do that a little bit. We've learned to accept ourselves and be comfortable with ourselves, and that's why we can give, because we are not threatened, not because we are threatened. It's that famous analogy of the plane. You know, the announcement they always make on the plane, that if there's, God forbid, a pressure drop or something, the oxygen masks will fall from the whatever they call them, right? And it says you must put them over your nose and mouth and breathe normally. And in case of children, fix your own mask first and then do it for your children. It's such a beautiful parenting principle and life principle. If you have no identity, you can't really give to others. If you are nothing, you actually can't really properly give to others. Because you know, as important as giving is, and as giving is such a fundamental concept in Jewish thinking, but it's important for someone to give. You have to be a giver. The whole world was designed so there's giving and receiving. That's the way God designed the universe, that there's givers and receivers. In fact, we're all givers and receivers. But the idea is that there's connection between people. There has to be a giver and there has to be a receiver. There has to be someone that gives and someone that receives. Not a no one that gives or a no one that receives. And therefore, if you don't have an identity, if our whole identity is dependent on others, we can't actually give. There's a beautiful passage in the Talmud, an interesting passage, that talks about, the context, the interesting context, the context is praying in shul. And it talks about the importance of having what's called a makom kavua. Makom kavua means, it says in code, in fact, not only in shul, it says in the code of Jewish law, that it's important that when you have a synagogue, you should have a set place. You should have a set place to pray. But it doesn't mean that if you come to shul and someone else is in your place, that you know, you inch forward and you say, no, please sit there, like, you know. You know, so, you know. You see, we'll do that like they come closer if it's their place and they sort of, I just want to get my sit. No, but you can sit there. Because actually it says you actually don't have to always sit in the exact place. It says it's within a radius of four cubits. It's also okay. But the concept of having a set place to pray, right? So it says, a very strange sentence. It says, Kola kovea makom letfilato. Anyone who creates a set place to pray, and in fact, the Kodu Jewish law suggests that if someone prays at home, then it should also have a set place to pray. Even at home, you should have a corner or a place where they pray. Right? But it says, whoever does that, the God of Abraham will come to assist him. Will help him. Now, on a simple level, what that means is, you know, sometimes these passages can be understood on many different levels. On a simple level, what that means is as follows, that the Talmud is encouraging a focus when you pray, right? So when you always have a set place you pray, it helps with your focus. In other words, it enhances your prayer, and enhances your prayer, and therefore God will help you more, because God will listen to your prayers more, and therefore whoever does that will receive a greater level, a deeper level of divine assistance. Okay, fine. The question is this. Why does the Talmud say whoever makes a set place to pray, the God of Abraham will help him? I mean, it's God of Abraham, it's the God of Isaac, God of Jacob, he's everyone's God. I mean, what do you mean the God of Abraham will help him? Right? So on a deeper level, what this means is as follows. What does it mean the God of Abraham? We just said this before. Abraham was renowned for giving. Abraham was renowned for making room for others. Abraham desperately wanted guests. When he was circumcised and God took out the son from its shield, as it says, and made it an incredibly hot day so that wayfarers shouldn't come by and not disturb, he was distressed because he wanted to give. But he didn't want to give from a weakness. He wanted to give from a strength. So the Talmud says, if you want to have the God of Abraham, in other words, you want to have this trait of giving, you have to establish yourself. Kala kaver, if you make a set place to pray, it's not just to pray. If you make a set place, if you know your identity, if you know where you are, if you're comfortable with yourself, if you have a sense, a healthy sense of self, then God of Abraham will help you. Then you can be connected to the God of Abraham. In other words, you can give, you can make room for others. You know, an interesting thing, you see it with Abraham. I'll show you an interesting thing. Talking about Abraham. Next week's parsha, which talks about the story about Abraham sitting outside the tent waiting for visitors, right? So there's a very interesting passage there. He sees these, God sends, he was distressed that there was no visitors. He wanted to give. His life was surrounded of giving to others. So God sends him guests. Who were the guests? They were angels clothed in human body. They looked like Arabs, it says. Arabs in those days meant something different than Arabs now, but right? They looked like Arabs, and he ran to greet them. So he tells them, please, please come in, have a meal. But he tells them, wash your feet before you come into my house. Now, what kind of hospitality is that? What do you mean, wash your feet before you come to the house? Like, conditional? Like, you know, please come in, but, you know, I'm very clean. Like, you know. So the commentaries tell us, Rashi says this, and the commentaries tell us a very interesting thing. One of the things that Abraham also stood for was monotheism, was one of his values. He spread monotheistic belief in the world. He was all about fighting the pagan culture of the times, fighting the whole culture of serving idols, and encouraging people to believe in one God. At the time, one of the pagan practices around was people bowing down to the dust of their feet. Right? So Abraham wants to give. Abraham will give to anyone. Jew, non-Jew, pagan worshiper, anyone. No problem. He'll make room for anyone. But it's coming from his strength. So as he gives, he's able to have the strength to say, but I have values. I have a sense of self. I have certain values. And as much as I'm desperate to give, and I'm desperate to be hospitable, you're not coming to my house with idol worship. My house doesn't take idol worship. You see, that's the difference. If someone gives only because of approval, then there's no values. There's no strength. You can never say no. There's no boundaries. Then you get complicated. Then you resent. Then you feel bad because you compromised yourself. Giving is critical. And giving is possible when you have a good sense of self. But when you have a good sense of self, it's from a strength. And therefore, it contradicts your values. And it contradicts your balance in your life. And it contradicts other, maybe equally, or more important priorities. You have a sense of balance. You know when to say no. You know how to schedule it so that you're giving from a strength, not from a weakness. And Abraham is able to turn around and say, but you're not bringing idol worship into my home. because my home is protected. That's one of the values in my house. I don't allow idol worship to my house. So now let's go back to the principle. The principle of the school I'm talking about. Not the principle with an A. Right. No one should ever reward people or praise people for things that they don't do. That's just false. Right. And certainly there shouldn't be 8 duxes in a school, because in a class, because that's also false. 8 people can't come first, only 1 person comes first. Right? But the problem is a whole different problem. And let's talk about it in a school context, but it applies to all of us. But it's so important on a child level, because we do need to be very careful about the messages we send children and how they end up developing this identity that is so based on the approval of other people. Right? See, the truth is that the whole concept of a everyone should be rewarded for achievement and for excellence, and I'm certainly not undermining that. But the whole concept of coming first and always constantly rewarding those that come first is absurd. And the reason it's absurd is like this. The only message you send someone, or a group, or a class, or anyone for that matter, when you reward those that did the best, is that success is defined in relation to other people. You are successful because, not because you did well, because you did better than everyone else. You weren't successful, you weren't praised, you didn't receive a prize, or whatever it is, because you didn't do better than everyone else. You understand how crazy that is?
Yeah. What about
sport? So true, I agree with you. There's something, there is something called healthy competition. Right? Healthy competition is not a problem. Right? Healthy competition is inbuilt, but it doesn't mean that there's a very big difference when you create a bit of healthy competition to either create the entertainment, sport wouldn't exist without a competition, right? Or the Talmud says, competition between scholars enhances wisdom, yeah? Because a bit of healthy competition is good, because a bit of benchmarking is okay. In other words, there's nothing wrong with having a little bit of a benchmark to know what could be achieved, so you aspire to get there, or you compete with it in a healthy way. But when you start defining your identity that way, that's when it's dangerous, right? And I think probably in sport, it's also been taken much too much to an unhealthy extreme as well, right? So no one is suggesting that the whole concept of competition shouldn't exist, right? But don't forget, in a classroom setting, there's a natural competition anyways. Everyone knows what everyone else is doing, right?
So you think rewarding a person at school who's come first is a worthwhile cause?
It depends why you're rewarding them. You see, the thing is like this. Let's define... Let's go back to the concept of competencies, right? You see, yeah, I know this is a little bit controversial, but it's okay. But I feel very, very strongly about this. But because let's understand. Let's take a mathematical thing, right? Let's take two classes. It's a simple maths equation, right? One class is a bit of a weaker class, so the one guy gets a prize because he got 82. So why did he get a prize? Because everyone else got in the 70s, right? In the next class, coming up the next day, there was a brilliant student who worked really, really hard with a bit of brains and effort. He got himself a 91 and doesn't get recognized. Why? Because some really, really bright kid happened to get 93. Does that make sense to you? Not to me. Right? Yeah. No, so the point is this. I'm not saying people shouldn't be rewarded. I'm saying, I want to focus really on the message here, right? Message is this. We define self-esteem in the beginning as having intrinsic value and having competencies. Now, what is that? Let's go back to the definition of competency. A competency doesn't mean that you can achieve. A competency means that you can accomplish. A competency doesn't necessarily mean a talent. But you know what it does mean? A competency in the human sense means that you can do better than yourself. That's what it means. Right? A competency means that every human being, one thing that every single human being can do is grow. One thing that every single human being can do, as long as they are called a human being and not an animal, every human being can go beyond their own effort, okay, beyond their own level of comfort, as we've talked about so, so many times. I don't know how you do this, because it's less quantifiable, But somehow we have to design a culture in a society where we reward people for doing better than themselves. Right? So as I say, it's hard to quantify that, and there's many, many ways of doing it, and now's not certainly not the time to discuss it. But the message that we tell children from very young age, that success, and that's what happens in society. It flows on from, the only reason I bring it into school age is because that's what happens to the rest of society. That success becomes defined by doing it better than other people. Right? And not only success becomes defined the way, but that becomes the definition of the human being. Now, of course, if I'm not well and I'm going to look for a doctor, I'm going to look for a better doctor. Fine. Does that make the better doctor a better human being? No. I need good medical assistance. I'm going to go to the person that can do that. That God helped him or helped that person together with the effort achieve good medical results and be a good medical practitioner. That doesn't make the person a better human being.
No, but
that doesn't make
him to be your friend. You're choosing him for a doctor.
Correct. Exactly. So I'm not choosing him as a human being as such, right? So there I'm looking for a skill. Everyone has different skills. So when I need a doctor, got a good doctor. You know, plumber, you look for a good plumber, and that's fine, right? And there's nothing wrong with a bit of, and that's a natural thing which will come out. You know, if that's a natural consequence of capitalism, that if you want to have a job, you try to do the best you can in the field that you choose, so that people will choose you and you'll make a living. Okay, that's fine. But when we're talking about defining success, when we're talking about defining the identity of a human being, it is such a terrible message to say that you are only rewarded if you did better than everyone else. Because what happens, and this certainly happens, because I've seen it happen, what happens when you do that is this. It is effective for two or three kids in the class, and by the way, that's true in all society, because there were two or three kids in the class who will fight for that first place. So yes, someone will give you the argument that it encourages more excellence. It sure does. Out of the 33 kids, it encourages excellence for three of them. Correct? Right? And it makes the rest of them plateau. Absolutely. Why should I? Why should a kid go through school from year K till year 12? And I've seen this. I've seen kids go through the whole school, doing their homework, behaving, being polite, trying hard, studying for tests, being just good citizen, and totally unnoticed from beginning to end. In fact, you have kids, not only who are just generally good kids, you have kids who do better than they can, who really work hard. And the reality is that you don't become a good human being with God-given talent. A kid or a human being or a person that does a little bit better, see, that's the problem. What's better? Now, the question is not who's more pleasant, but what's a truly better human being? A human being that never gets angry because they're just born with that temperament, they just never lose their temper. I know such people. Very few, but you hardly ever meet them, but there are some people. Are people that are just super calm, never lose their temper. Right? Or someone who's born with a real problem, an anger problem, to the point where they blow up 17 times a week, and now they've worked on themselves so much, they only blow up 8 times a week. Right? That person only blows up 8 times a week is a far superior human being. Because they've worked on themselves, they've grown. That's competency. They're not doing better than the other guy. Maybe the other person will become a better human being is if they work on their challenges. Because guess what? Everyone has challenges, right? So the guy never becomes angry, has a different challenge. Okay? But somehow we've got to develop that culture in society where we send a message to ourselves, to our children, to our friends, to everyone, that we respect, we reward, we value people that grow within themselves. That's real competency.
I suppose you can do that at home. You can't expect it to be in a school environment, for example.
Yeah, I think you can.
Struggling with an old concept.
I can. I've been fighting this for many years. If you want, after I'll tell you. I've actually.
Do you know that?
Yeah, I've made some changes in some areas where it's actually been done differently. Yeah. But not for now. Let me quickly, in the few minutes we have left. How do we do this? So what's the strategy? Right? We weren't here to talk about child education. We're here to talk about ourselves. Although it's very important. The first strategy is, it's a paradigm shift. It's a mindset shift. This is actually something that we need to think about every single day. We kind of have to get up every day in the morning, and after we thank God for returning our soul, as we talked about in the gratitude sessions, we actually have to start the day by remembering that I'm intrinsically a good person. I'm going to make the best of today. I'm going to try my best to nurture my strengths and to take responsibility for my weaknesses, which we'll talk about next week in greater detail. But I'm not defined by other people. I'm defined by my own intrinsic worth and by the ability to grow as a human being and do the very best that I can. It's a tape that you've got to play in your mind. Can't say tape anymore. It's a CD or a digital thing, right? You've got to play in your mind every single day. Seriously, that's number one strategy. The second strategy is, and I'm doing this briefly because we're coming to an end, and we'll maybe elaborate a bit more next week. The second strategy is a different skill that we have to learn. And some people struggle with this more than others, right? And that is to learn to become decisive. You know how sometimes some people just can't make decisions? And sometimes it's because we're trying to guess, second guess what the other person is thinking. Right? We have to learn to become decisive people. Not arrogant people, decisive people. Assertive people. To know how to make a decision, to decide what is right, and make a decision. And if you later on, you made a mistake, you'll admit your mistake. And the third thing is, which I want to just mention briefly, that we have to spread this message to other people. And the way we do it, because then we get it ourselves as well. You know, sometimes when you do something for others, you absorb it yourself. And we have to learn the art of accepting other people unconditionally. See, this is all about that you're not defined by your success, so you're not defined by your approval rating from other people. Right? That will leave for the polls, for the presidents that fight it out. But most people are not defined by the approval rating of others. Which really means, therefore, that even though every person has strengths and weaknesses, but we accept people as a whole. We love them and our friends and our loved ones unconditionally. We need to learn to do that, because when we learn to do that, we get it back in return. And the only way to build a culture of not being defined by the approval of others is this concept of acceptance. But we'll elaborate that a bit more next week, and also next week we're going to take this now to step further about how do we use this concept to nurture our strengths and take responsibility for our weaknesses. Have a great